And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Earth, our home, is a great mystery. Cultures around the world have wondrous stories of how it all came to be. Indigenous people see the animals, plants, and humans as interconnected. So why has the Earth, what many believe to be the work of God's hand, taken such a beating and yet remained a minimal part of the mainstream faith communities? We explore this mystery and what is happening in churches, synagogues, and mosques across America as they reunite with the creation. When we return here on the Wild Side News. So where do you come in on this emerging story of the future of life on Earth? Do you think about it? Do you care? Does it matter? Well, on the Wild Side News, we bring you each week the latest updates on what scientists and researchers are discovering about global warming, the oceans, our forests, land, and cohabitors of planet Earth. And the story keeps getting more dramatic. Serious discussions are taking place about the potentials for radical shifts in animal populations, some referring to them even as mass extinctions. If such is true, we have dropped the ball big time. Our paradise of wonder, this Garden of Eden, to which we were given dominion, according to some ancient faiths, is under siege. For many of us who have been championing the cause to save this earthly mystery, we have been perplexed by the near total lack of concern or involvement by those who are tied to the divine plan by covenant, whether they be Christian, Jew, or Muslim, or others. And to many, the continuing silence is what is most astonishing, as the research and rumors raise the prospect of dramatic earthly upheaval. But things are changing in the God-Earth community. Congregations of all faiths are coming together to address the spiritual nature of nature and the requirement to love and care for God's creation. Today, we spend the hour talking about what is emerging in the creation care movement. We begin the show with a visit to one of the nation's premier cathedrals, the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and talk with the Episcopal Reverend Sally Bingham and the Regeneration Project. We continue our discussion as we delve deeper into the interpretation of the spiritual nature of Earth and God's purpose in putting it all together during our second segment. Then, in segment three, we head on over to Michigan and talk with Mark Cleavy and the Energy Star program that is saving money, saving energy, saving the planet, and in the long term, saving souls. It's a divine union of sorts that brings a positive realignment back into the churches. So, following a brief look at the news, we focus on emerging work of Churches United for the Earth. But first, the news. President Bush is finding many within his faith-based coalition coalescing in a new campaign, a campaign to save the environment. More than 1,000 Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish leaders are spreading a petition pressing Bush to change his environmental policies. The environment is a values issue, said Reverend Ted Haggard, president of the 30-million-member National Association of Evangelicals. In a strange twist, the group is organizing to protect unborn fetuses, which can suffer harm from mercury pollution, regulations which the president's Clear Skies initiative relaxed. And many evangelicals, who shy away from the term environmentalist, are wearing the robe of creation care, which states the mission from a God-centered perspective. The effort is being joined by none other than James Dobson of Focus on the Family, who is parting ways with the administration over the environment. Many find it interesting that this alliance is leading the way, as memories of a total lack of the term environment being even mentioned during the debates by either candidate rattle in the halls of history. We visit this topic during our show today. A Portland, Oregon judge has ruled that the Bush administration's relaxed protections for the western gray wolf violated the Endangered Species Act. In a unique form of gerrymandering, the U.S. wolf population was divided east and west, as the wolves in a few areas would make up for the absence of wolves in much larger regions. The classification of wolf status was sort of generalized by Interior Secretary Gail Norton, according to Michael Robinson of the Center for Biological Diversity. We will keep you informed of this ruling and its effects on the U.S. wolf population in the months ahead. The House is about to rule on a bill to reopen ANWR for oil and gas exploration against the strong opposition by various conservation organizations in order to reduce reliance on Middle East oil, according to President Bush. Moderate Republicans and Democrats in the Senate oppose the move, as they believe the refuge does not hold enough crude to justify the destruction of habitat critical to polar bears, caribou, and other wildlife. OPEC, meanwhile, decided to hold production at current levels, which is fueling a new standard in a barrel of oil at $50. OPEC believes this new price will not have deleterious effects on the global economy. The good old days are gone. Gone are the days when citizens could unite in class action suits and challenge various threats by taking the accused violators to state court. No longer. The Class Action Fairness Act now moves essentially all class action suits to the federal level, thereby necessitating much greater legal fees to litigate and dramatically extending the time required to try the cases. Amendments by Senators Kennedy and Bingaman will attempt to mitigate these requirements, thus bringing such actions back to the people in their own states. Remember Antarctica, the vast frozen continent? Well, scientists recently noted that the effects of global warming could make one half of the continent unstable and potentially cause it to break off from its underwater rock support and plunge into the ocean. It may take a while, but leading scientists predict that if such were to happen, the sea would rise by 16 feet. Whereas this had been predicted to happen sometime in the next 100 to 1,000 years, the time frame has shrunk. If such happened, it would have catastrophic effects around the world, as whole nations and regions would be submerged. Noah, Noah, where art thou? One of our most wonderful earthly companions, the orangutans, those slow-moving, ET-inspiring friends of the Earth, may disappear within 10 to 20 years. Sounds like a long way off? No. That's a couple and a half presidential terms away. These natural tree huggers live 99% of their lives in trees. So, as their native forests continue to be broken and penetrated by legal and illegal logging, their future is compromised. And to add to the dilemma, their natural habits make the challenge of their survival even greater. Females are not inclined to want to move from their homes. Therefore, as food supplies diminish, so too their health and strength. And unlike other mammalian species, orangutan females only bear children once every 8 years. That means they are facing little more than one generation of existence. Sounds challenging. It is. We must awaken to the need to act now, globally, to address our future on this planet. And that's the news. We are joined now by Reverend Sally Bingham at the legendary Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. Sally, let's begin with you telling us about the wondrous Grace Cathedral.
Oh, Grace Cathedral is a beautiful Gothic cathedral. It's, I think, the third largest in this country, and it sits on the top of Nob Hill. It has beautiful stained glass windows and some Italian doors that were created by Ghiberti. It's quite a lovely place. It's quite large.
And how long ago was it actually constructed?
They started building it in the early 1900s, got to about halfway through in the 30s, and then ran out of money and did not start construction again until 1960, and then completed the cathedral with the stairs and the cathedral house and diocesan house and the school, all completed by 1964.
Well, it's a seriously large place, and that may have something to do with the emergence of your effort to become more energy conscious and the beginning of your work.
It's true. The cathedral didn't actually start me thinking about the work I do, but I certainly have tried to implement some of what I believe at the cathedral, in some cases more successful than others. Because the cathedral is so large, we pay in the area of $10,000 a month for heating. That's for the whole close, not just the cathedral, but it's still an enormous amount of money that we spend on electricity. And I have talked to the trustees, and we're entertaining the idea of putting solar on our roof, which would be really a wonderful thing, and it would be a nice icon for the city, too.
Very interesting. Well, I think part of this effort to really address the energy conservation aspect, and we're going to talk about the spiritual aspects of the environment in our second segment, but this concept of your efforts to create the Regeneration Project and something that has become known now as the IPL, which is spreading across the country, began back in the 1990s with the energy crisis in California.
Mm-hmm. And largely because people's electrical bills were so enormous, we could start with conservation right away, and that's one of the things we've done at the cathedral, where we haven't succeeded in having solar put on the roof yet. We have put in sensors in the bathroom so that there are no lights going when no one's in there. Often children will run into a room and then leave lights on, and they'll stay on for a week before somebody comes back in. In small parishes around the countryside, that happens. But we have recommended that churches put sensors in their bathrooms and that they use compact fluorescent light bulbs all over the facility. And there even are the kind that work the way a spotlight does for a big sanctuary. We have LED exit lights, which use considerably less electricity, and that's a money-saving technology, and it at the same time saves churches from putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the air because they're cutting down on their usage. But the hook for congregations in the very beginning of this work in the early 1990s was actually saving money for the parish. And then we asked them to get energy-efficient appliances because, as you probably know, the old refrigerators that hang around parishes that have been there for 30 and 40 years are very inefficient energy users. And if you can replace a refrigerator, you can save your congregation a lot of money as well.
Well, this started out sort of focused around the Grace Cathedral, but it has been growing. Well, let's talk about what is emerging.
Well, we started a program called Episcopal Power and Light, and the notion was that we'd ask all Episcopal churches across this country to buy renewable energy because we can't do it in California now, but there still are plenty of states around the country where you can buy energy directly from a clean, renewable source. That would be sun, wind, biomass, geothermal, and hydro. Those are things that do not create greenhouse gases. When a congregation can buy their electricity from one of these green marketers and they talk about it in the church, then people will go back into their homes and do the same thing. So we started this in 1997, Episcopal Power and Light. Well, within about 3 years, we had Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, all kinds of different denominations who were interested in joining us, and I would get phone calls saying, is this just for Episcopal churches? Sort of simultaneously with the curiosity from other denominations, California went through the energy crisis. So I went up and allied with the California Council of Churches, and because during that energy crisis, the green marketers left California, all of our churches that had switched over to a green company were switched back to our regular utility, and the green marketers went off to other states. But what we did is decided we would get involved in the politics of this energy move, and that we would also continue on a energy conservation movement, if you will, mm-hmm. for congregations, asking them to cut their energy use, and then we got politically involved and helped pass this clean car bill that happened out here in California just last year. As we became more well known for working with congregations and people in the pews, we were funded by a national foundation to get a national campaign manager who we hired, and now we are working in 15 states and in Washington, D.C. We have a Massachusetts Interfaith Power and Light, Maine, Illinois, Georgia, New Jersey, Oregon, New Mexico, and on and on. And they are cropping up around the country with an affiliation to us, and they agree to work with our principles. And all of that information, how to become an Interfaith Power and Light program in your state, is all on our website, which is www.theregenerationproject.org. That's the actual ministry nonprofit that I'm the executive director of.
And how did you choose the Regeneration Project as a name?
Regeneration is a spiritual renewal. And we thought that when you talk about generation for energy, I mean, where does it come from? You're talking about generators. And then it tied into spiritual renewal and regeneration of the soul. And it just seemed like there was no other word but the Regeneration Project.
It's a great term and a great concept, and ultimately, hopefully, a great transformative force.
Well, that's what we're hoping. We're very hopeful that if we can have, maybe Interfaith Power and Light programs in 25 states over the next 5 years, that it'll be a real movement, that we can say the religious community not only is making a difference, but is starting a kind of third wave, another movement like the civil rights movement. We think that any really successful cultural change in this country has been led by the religious community, and the hope is here that we are now in a leadership position to lead again, to get the U.S. off its dependency on fossil fuel for energy.
Now, in terms of real effect, the churches that are participating, is there any estimate in terms of the energy that is being saved across the country as a result of your work?
Mm-hmm. We have here in California, where we have 300 congregations, it's over 300, it's probably 315 congregations that have joined, and that represents about roughly 120,000 people. We calculated last year when we did our annual report that we had prevented 19,000 tons of CO2 from entering the atmosphere.
That's astonishing.
And my guess is that the other programs, we're right now creating a way that our members can go into the website, mm-hmm. and say, we put in 35 compact fluorescent light bulbs, we got a new refrigerator, and we have solar on our roof. And this program will calculate how much CO2 has been prevented from going into the atmosphere. And the Environmental Protection Agency is working on that with us.
It's interesting that the government, how is it? Because a lot of people would suggest that the government and churches are supposed to have a hands-off policy. Something's different here.
Well, it is different because the Environmental Protection Agency has something that they call Energy Star. You may have even seen some of the advertisements for Energy Star appliances.
Certainly, everyone does, yeah.
Okay. They have Energy Star congregations, and you can find it on the EPA website. And when one of our congregations joins a program, they become a member of the Energy Star program as well, and they have a hotline. There's an 800 number where the congregation folks can call in and get information over the telephone from the EPA.
That's so interesting. So across the nation, I mean, the statistics that you gave really were for California, but when you start adding 25 states, we're talking about a serious impact, and yet, in reality, it's just the beginning, isn't it?
It is just a beginning, and you know, Sydney, there are 340,000 houses of worship in this country.
Wow.
And our program is probably reaching not more than about 2,000 right now, but we're new. I mean, this is a new idea for a lot of congregations. When I go in and talk to people about environmental stewardship, they don't grasp and embrace this message until they've heard it a couple of times, but once they get it, then, you know, we're really on our way to doing something great. And I feel that this snowball that's turning is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Why do you think it's taken the churches this long to really see the importance of this type of work to serve the earth, which, after all, from many different perspectives, religious perspectives, is the work of God's hand?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. I think for a number of years, the religious community felt that anything that had to do with the environment could be taken care of by the environmental community. And it's only recently that the religious leaders have come to realize that human behavior is destroying what God created for us to have, not just now, but for all the generations that come after us. And now that religious leaders are realizing that stewardship of creation is very much a part of who they are as people of faith, if you say you love God, you have a responsibility to take care of God's creation. And I believe, up until quite recently, they just thought the environmental community would take care of it. And believe me, clergy people are very busy. And when they go to seminary, they don't learn about, they don't learn environmental ethics, and they don't take classes in ecology. They go to seminary and they learn liturgy and they learn how to pray with people and they learn how to do pastoral care at the bedside and visiting people in prisons and hospitals and how to, if you have a congregation of 400 people that you look after, you have to deal with sorrows and joys and weddings and baptisms. And I think that probably they wish that the environmental community was taking care of all the environmental problems. I don't think they've ever been disinterested. I think that it just hasn't been a priority. But I believe that in the last 3 to 5 years, it has become a priority. You might notice that there's a lot going on in the press these days with religious leaders saying this and that, writing letters to George Bush and saying that we want to do something about global warming.
It's an interesting matrix in the sense that even many within the environmental community itself have kind of a hands-off relationship with the church for various reasons. And yet the success of their movement is so dependent upon getting the message out and really involving a vast cross-section of American population. And quite honestly, I don't think there is any more effective network, if you just bring it right down to that, then actually the churches, and you're bringing that network together so effectively in this effort.
Well, this is what's been so extraordinary, but it also, there's a very fine line now and a kind of thread we can't break between remaining completely theological and coming at this with a foundation in religion versus coming at it from an environmental perspective, because as you probably know, there are a lot of objections in certain communities to environmentalists, and we don't want to be seen as environmentalists because we're not. I mean, we're not tree huggers in the sense that we love trees more than people. Our care and concern for creation is because we are part of creation, not separate from it, but actually part of it. We have a place in this web of life. And if the balance is being disturbed, it's up to people of faith to help it stay in balance. Not because we like to put on our backpacks and our hiking shoes and go out climbing in Yosemite, as much as we've been called to be stewards of creation, stewards of each other, to serve one another, to love our neighbors as ourselves. And those are theological, moral reasons for taking care of creation. So when we're invited, which happens often now, environmental groups come to the religious communities looking for language that will reach out to perhaps the evangelical crowd or just to get the message that environmental communities, environmental groups care, are stewards too. And they like to use some of the religious language. We like to share our language, but we have to be very careful not to be usurped and be called the Sierra Club at prayer. Because you can see where if I wear an environmental hat and go into a congregation that's skeptical anyway, I'm not going to be very well received. But if I go in as a priest with my foundation in theology and I talk about service to one another and service to God, they get the message.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sally, I want you to hold on, because when we come back, we're going to search the scriptures of sorts for the secrets of God's gift of life and the special role we humans have in this divine plan. We're going to take a look at the spiritual nature of nature when we return here on the Wild Side News, as we bring you the voice of the earth around the world.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There are lots of ways to connect with nature. We take walks, we ride bikes, we read and head to the wilderness, and in most cases, we find a special clearing that comes with our connections with the wild places. To many, it is a communion. A communion with what? Some mysterious truth? Some powerful force? Yes, to many, it is a way to sense the divine. When we return, we continue our quest into the mysteries of the spiritual nature of nature here on the Wild Side News, your 24/7 listening post to the voice of the earth. The environment. It's a term that is being debated these days as people who work to protect the environment begin to craft a more meaningful definition. The environment, it embraces so much. Some would say too much. The environmental movement began with efforts to save the life systems, the animals and forests, the ponds and rivers, and all the miraculous life that dwelt within. But as the efforts became united into the environmental movement, laws and regulations were crafted to give teeth to the effort. And with that came issues of air quality, water, pollution, particulates, toxins, and endangered places and species. And with that, a confusion by many about the environmental movement itself, as the political parties tugged from both sides of the issue. And for reasons that we hope to explore today, the churches fell silent as the earth was rent and the gift of life became exploited and now endangered. We continue our discussion with Sally Bingham, Reverend with the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, an Episcopal church. Sally, when you talk about this issue, how do you begin to define humanity's place amongst the living beings?
I love that question, and if all of your listeners could have the great opportunity that I had to go to the Natural History Museum in New York and experience that Big Bang exhibit. We are all one. And that, in a sentence, is the answer to your question. But for more detail and how do I come to believe that, it's my understanding that with very, very slight variation, you and I have the same DNA as an oak tree. And when we talk about our connection to nature as it is, think in terms of every time you've ever gone into the forest or to the seashore, the temptation to lean over and pick up a rock or pick up a barnacle or a pine cone out of the forest and take it home with you. I think we do that because we belong to it. We belong to those natural things. They're part of us. And I'm a believer in the Big Bang. I'm a believer in evolution. I think when God put all this into motion, it came from the same source, which is love. And I believe as people of faith, the recognition that we are part of this huge web of life and that we have a role to play in it that is perhaps more important than the trees and the squirrels. I'm not saying we're more important to God than they are, but we certainly have a more important role because we have the ability to reason and think and look after. And if we take the message in the Bible, we're given dominion over these things, and we are just by virtue of that given the responsibility to care for and be stewards of everything that God created. and that means stewardship.
Now, of course, that is where, as people debate this issue within the faith communities, some of the problems emerge, where some people would suggest that this was given to us for our well-being, and others might argue that it was given to us to take care of. How do you sort that out?
Well, just the other night on Larry King Live, there was an evangelical minister, and Larry King asked him about the environment. He said, well, what about the environment? And this man said, well, the environment was given to us to use. Well, I was madly trying to dial on my telephone to get the Larry King show because it was a call-in. It turns out what I was watching was pre-recorded. But don't you have to ask this man? Maybe it was given to us to use, but was it only given to our generation? I don't believe that. I think that it was given for all generations, our children, our grandchildren, their grandchildren, and on and on and on and on. And you can't use something and exploit it, overuse it, and consider that to be in any way compassionate or loving. If you use it up, it isn't going to be there to use, if you're following my
Sure. thinking. Well, part of that is the fact that we've learned that we used to think that this extraordinary earth was limitless. I mean, and I experienced that in my life, where the forest seemed infinite, and you'd cross the country and you'd hear about faraway lands, and they seemed like some other place. We've learned that this is a very small little planet. In reality, there are limits, and I think that's what we're having to face almost in crafting a new theology.
It's true, and I too. I mean, when I grew up, people were still dumping the sewage off their boats into lakes and rivers. Now all that has changed, and we have the evidence of too much mercury in children, in mother's milk, in people. That's coming from the dirty burning power plants. The fish get the mercury in them, and then we eat the fish, and it's this amazing cycle. And if there's an overabundance of mercury, which is harmful, lead, any of those toxins that we are getting too much of because we have not been mindful of our dumping ground, and we don't have dumping grounds anymore. We can't throw things away because there is no more away. If it goes into the ocean, the fish eat it, we eat the fish. If we, you know, all these, with the air too, and getting back to the theological part of it, the first and great commandment is to love God. The second is to love your neighbor as yourself. If you love your neighbor, truly love your neighbors, and our neighbors are not just the people next door, the neighbors are the people on the other side of the country. If you love your neighbor, you would not pollute your neighbor's air or water, because someone is always going to be downstream from you. And then if you can take a broader view of who is my neighbor, I think our neighbors are the people on the other side of the world. And if you're talking about a global environmental problem like climate change, the folks that are going to be the most seriously and adversely hurt by climate change are the low-lying islands in the South Pacific and places like Bangladesh. If we here in the United States are creating most of the greenhouse gases that are causing the climate to change, it's a matter of social justice. Well, it's back into loving your neighbor. It's a moral issue about how do we live our lives and how do we treat other people. These are issues that have always involved the faith community, the social justice side, the environmental justice side, if you will, is what brings the church into this.
I think you make such a great point about this concept of neighbor, because it can be taken quite almost too literally. You know, your neighbor, the people that you come in contact with. But this is a global community now, and we are all neighbors, and we share the same air and now the same water, and we share the same fate.
That's
and
right.
And we're learning that. So we need, again, to, in essence, broaden out our theological perspective to embrace all the people on the earth as neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if we care for our neighbors, we must care for those who we may not see
mm-hmm.
and know.
Never mind the next generations, you know, they're part of our, they're our neighbors too, the people that come after us. And other species are our neighbors.
I was going to ask you about that. I'm just curious if you, you know, from a theological perspective, I mean, for example, you know, there's a difference between Old Testament covenant and the New Testament covenant, but certainly a huge story of the Old Testament is the story of Noah. What can you tell us about that in terms of your interpretation of that, about mankind and the animals?
Well, sometimes it's said that the first Endangered Species Act was between God and Noah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then, of course, this changed as well with the emergence of Christianity, Christ, who was a practitioner of love for the gentle lambs in his flock.
Mm-hmm.
What are the lessons to be learned from this in terms of environmental stewardship?
Well, Jesus always sided with the marginalized. And you'll remember from some of the parables that he went outside of his own group and took in the Samaritans and took in women who were considered, you know, untouchable, took in beggars and tax collectors who were also seen as the enemy. Now, there was probably not the amount of environmental degradation in Jesus' time that there is today, but I practically guarantee of what I know about Jesus, he would have been embracing trees because they are being marginalized. I mean, they are just being cut down at such a rapid rate that it's shocking. And I think that anything like filling in our wetlands, I think he'd side with the wetlands.
Now, as we look out to the future, I mean, some within the faith-based communities are actually now beginning to address concepts of mass extinction. Are you hearing those rumors as well?
When you say mass extinction, you mean like Armageddon or the rapture, end of the world?
No, just the fact that there is an emerging breakdown of natural systems that could really, that is impacting the natural dynamics, the life webs that keep this whole thing. It's the mysterious, miraculous relationship, and unfortunately that gift, which was a miraculous gift, is being truly threatened into the future. And
I think that is true. And yes, I have heard that there are species that are dying out. And I also am well aware, because I've had cancer and went through chemotherapy and cancer treatment, listening to the doctors and other people talking about cancer treatments and the demise of our tropical rainforests. We are cutting down and destroying forests that probably contain a great deal of medicinal value, and we're taking them down before we even know what that value is, and losing species in the rainforest that could potentially be the cure to a lot of these diseases.
You know, I also want to say that we're talking from a Judeo side and the Christian side. Are you familiar with Muslim theology?
We have on our steering committees these Interfaith Power and Light programs. In order to be Interfaith Power and Light programs and qualify under our little our umbrella and use that name, they have to actually be interfaith. And some of these groups have Jewish, Christian, and Muslim folks involved. We actually have a Buddhist and a Hindu out here in California that are part of the California Interfaith Power and Light. I have sat on panels with Muslims who talk about the Quran and that God created heaven and earth and everything in between, and that they too have a very strong mandate for care of creation. They have not focused on it, and it's new to them, and it's an interesting thing that's happening. And the wonderful thing that's occurring is that these Judeo-Christian Muslim religions all come together and agree on something. There's no fighting about whether or not we're called here to be good stewards of creation. We agree we are. All faiths agree on that. It's a very unifying subject.
You know, it's interesting because, unfortunately, so much of the pain and suffering on the planet right now is caused by strife between the religions.
Isn't that right? Yeah.
And isn't it sort of ironic that somehow in the process of not applying what God has given us, from my perspective, I'm comfortable saying that, which is wisdom and our great intelligence and our mind and our hands and bodies that can alter the environment to our will. We can either choose to will our work to serve life or not. And somehow in the process of manifesting miraculous technologies and things, we are unfortunately not applying this gift of intelligence and wisdom to our process. I'm just wondering what you think may happen in the future in terms of the emergence of, some people might talk about, a new dispensation on the planet here that can unite the religions to a greater extent to protect the gift.
Well, this may be the ministry. It may be around saving creation that the religions do unite. Certainly, they've tried for hundreds of years to unite around peace, and it hasn't seemed to work. But there's been so much environmental degradation done in these countries where that we're fighting, in oil countries, that when they burn those oil fields, when the rivers have all the bombs and explosions and toxics thrown into them, it takes... I don't have these statistics in my head either, but somebody did a study on what happened in Kuwait after the first Gulf War and the environmental problems that occurred after the war was over, from just things like if a bomb drops on a paint plant, all of that paint and everything that's in it and all the toxics around it are sprued out into the atmosphere and into whatever waterway happens to be nearby. And then without the proper screens and cleaning process for water, the inhabitants around these factories end up getting all that pollutants into their systems. And it goes on 10 years later, they find that people have gotten toxics that have come from the war that was there prior. These problems go on for years, and I believe that as we get more information from the scientific community about the real problem facing us, that it's going to bring religion. I think religion is the only way that this destroying creation is going to be stopped.
I think it's interesting, in this conversation, we've come from a statement that suggested that churches shied away from environmentalism, to a point where we're suggesting that the churches may lead the way to saving the environment. That's a big, giant step. And it's wonderful. You know, one of the miraculous things that the great mind of humankind has been able to create is the Internet, and therefore this message, for example, is available all over the world. If you were to address the religious leaders around the world, take a minute and tell them what you think is most important now as we look to the future.
Well, I think that all religious leaders in every part of the world, in every denomination, in every faith, must make saving creation a top priority. And for Christian leaders who listen, think of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and not one thing came into being that didn't come through the Word. Every living thing will be reconciled to God through Christ, and it makes creation central to Christianity. And for the Jewish community, the Old Testament is just swelling with how to take care of the land and our relationship with the land and our dependency on the land. If we don't take care of the land, and some, you know, the Native Americans call Mother Earth, we are not going to be healthy unless we keep our Mother Earth healthy. And it's, you can make the metaphor that an unhealthy pregnant young mother is not going to have a healthy baby. And if we don't maintain a healthy planet, the children of God are not going to be healthy, and nor are their children and the ones that come after us. And this should be a top priority for religious leaders to take on.
I want to thank Reverend Sally Bingham of the Grace Cathedral for shedding her light and wisdom on the Wild Side News. Thank you, Sally.
Thank you, Sydney.
And when we return, we take a look at faith in action and the emerging strategies to unite people, spirit, and nature through the churches, synagogues, and mosques to keep the mystery alive when we return here on the Wild Side News, the Voice of the Earth Radio Network.
Now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Churches are flocking to embrace a love and care for the earth. It's creation care, and it's more than just words, it's action. Faith in action means transforming the churches literally into an earth-sustaining vessel and bringing that mission into the faith-based communities across America. The voice of the earth goes to church when we return here on the Wild Side News. Should we love the earth, our home, love thy neighbor as thyself? Does this only apply to humans? Or perhaps is it time to expand this to include our neighboring creatures and the gift of the forests and prairies and seas that sustain us, the gift of life? These questions are being asked in churches across America, and some people, including myself, wonder why it's taken so long. Joining us now from Michigan is Mark Cleavy, director of the Energy Star program in Michigan. This is focusing its work on churches of all faiths. Mark, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
Let's start off by talking about what the Energy Star program for congregations is doing in Michigan.
Well, the Energy Star program is a program that was spawned from the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency over the last 10 years or so. And essentially, it is a program that promotes the purchase of Energy Star rated products across the United States. And Energy Star products are a trademark that is offered, and it simply says that a given Energy Star product uses less energy to perform the same function as non-Energy Star products. They include electronics, appliances, lighting, motors, all kinds of things. Essentially, anything that you can plug into a wall that uses electricity has the potential to be listed as an Energy Star product. And in Michigan, but we have a grant to promote the purchase and use of those Energy Star products by all rate classes, including those in congregations.
Now, why is this considered such a unique mission for the churches?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is churches have a spiritual mission, and there's a direct relationship between, you know, how we use energy and its impact on the planet. The more we waste energy, the more pollution there is, the higher the cost, the more we have to import. It goes round and round. So, you know, a church that is looking at the earth and the relationship to this earth clearly has to see a relationship between the energy that they use and their impact on the earth.
Let's talk about what happens if a church should decide to participate in the Energy Star program.
Well, we have a fairly unique program in Michigan that we decided to bring together small businesses that manufacture and sell Energy Star products and churches that buy those kinds of products. And we put together a program to make it easier for churches to buy energy-efficient equipment. Essentially, we set up a group called an Interfaith Power and Light nonprofit corporation. We funded that. And churches of all denominations join, and we have mosques and Jewish temples and Christian churches. They join, and when they join, we do two things. One is we set up an earth care team inside of the congregation, and that team looks at coordinating the Energy Star program inside the church, as well as setting up Sunday school programs and awareness programs and things like that about the relationship between the religion and environmental issues. As part of the Energy Star program, we literally send in an energy auditor who goes in and looks at everything that's plugged into the wall and looks to see if it's Energy Star rated or not, comes up with a purchasing plan to replace everything that they're using that isn't Energy Star rated, and then we collect those together. We have 90 churches that are members of the organization now, and we simply collect the items together. So, for example, if we find that 30 of them need new Energy Star or energy-efficient refrigerators, we then package those 30 refrigerators together and go out and negotiate a bulk discount from someone who sells Energy Star rated refrigerators. In this way, we're able to get deep discounts on the items that are being purchased, as well as expedite the process, as well as stimulate economic development in our state. So we are bringing business to small businesses that sell products, that we're opening up the market, increasing the market for energy-efficient products. We're reducing the amount of oil that's coming into the church, but also expanding the market for products that are based on fuels that are generated in the United States, in many cases green power, etc. We also then, after the second shoe in this process, is once the church has reduced its energy load by using energy efficiently, then we help them buy green power, and in part we have an agreement with NativeEnergy.com where our churches can actually buy energy from wind farms that are on Native American lands.
It's really a brilliant program, and certainly the effort to promote this out through the churches means that it can make a terrific difference, literally not only in, for example, a state, but as well across America, and this is really a national program.
Yes, it is a national program, although what we're doing in Michigan is different than the national program. Each state has the right to set up their Energy Star promotion program how they want. Some states simply give out information about Energy Star. Ours is one of the few that actually goes out and organizes an Energy Star-based purchasing program where we actually expedite the purchase, create the bulk discounts, and build in an energy audit financing mechanism and expedited purchasing.
That's called the aggregation purchase process, I believe.
Yes.
It's very, very bright. It's just economically sound, environmentally sound, and quite honestly, it can make an enormous difference. So let's say a church gets involved. What kind of real economic savings can they look to?
Well, a typical congregation can reduce their energy cost by 30%. By using just through energy efficiency and using Energy Star rated products. So we're talking about significant discounts and reduction in costs. Just as a fundraising process, if a church wants to expand its meals programs or whatever programs it is offering, this is one of the fastest ways to generate money for those kinds of programs.
That's interesting. By saving, you're making money.
Yes.
Making it available.
Yes, and in many cases, you can get a 200% return on investment by redoing your lights in your building. So, if you have a congregation who is, investing, has money and they've got it in a CD or in a bank or whatever, they're earning, 6% return on investment if they're doing well. If they take that same money and buy energy-efficient light bulbs, they'll get a 200% return on investment for that because the light bulbs will pay for themselves in just over, 3 to 4 months. So, we start looking at smart money, how we're going to use smart money, smart energy, and smart spirituality here. These things have to come together. There's no reason why a congregation can't operate and use sound business sense in what they're doing.
So how does the church organize for an Energy Star program in Michigan?
Well, when we formed a new nonprofit, the Interfaith Power and Light, it literally went out and has churches join, and they pay a nominal fee to join, and when they join, they get the Energy Star energy audit package that I've described. Then they also, as a group, they share resources, they set up Sunday school programs, and they do all kinds of things together with the Earth Care teams. And they have websites there, and they also interact with these IPLs, Interfaith Power and Lights, that are being set up in other states as well.
So how long does it take to start to see differences?
That's soon as they buy the first thing, I mean, literally, we could go in and say, you know, you've got a, you know, a fax machine here. You can change out the fax machine, and you'll see a, you know, $30 savings in the first year. So as soon as you shut the light off in your home, you're going to use less energy. So the savings is immediate. As soon as they recognize the financial implications of energy, the savings starts pretty fast. We've had now churches get together now and start broadening beyond energy to looking at how they do their recycling. Several of the churches that we were dealing with were actually subsidizing their recycling programs because they wanted to, because they believed that recycling was a good thing to do. We showed them how they could group together and get a larger volume so that they didn't have to subsidize the recycling. So we hooked them up with a recycler that actually goes out and does three churches in one pass rather than going one church at one time. And just by, in large cases, you know, just by looking at volume, you can change the economics on some of these kinds of programs. So we found with Energy Star, yes, an energy-efficient product usually costs more because it's made better. It just operates better, and that's why it uses energy efficiently. Because it's made better, it usually costs more. Well, we found that by simply aggregating those products, we could discount that increased cost, so people would get a better product for a lower price simply by making a bulk discount.
Now, in Michigan, there are 90 churches who are participating. How many actually could be participating in Michigan, for example?
Oh, thousands. There's no limit here. We've only been around for 2 years. So in the first year, we had 30 people. Within the first 6 months, we had 30 churches join up, and that has been expanding. We now do an annual conference and a number of things that are being added into this. We recently started working, President Bush's faith-based initiative offers financing and some grant programs through states, and we've recently tapped into the funding here in Michigan, and started looking at doing this project as part of President Bush's faith-based initiative. It meets those guidelines. So there's money available to launch these programs and to, you know, put together outreach and start working with people. We're even working in some churches where we're getting them grants from other sources to help them join MIPL and participate within their communities. Some of their community foundations, for example, and several of those. We had a local congressman here get together and bring all the churches together in his district, and then we would go in there and make a presentation to all the churches at once. About a third of them joined up that day. So it's getting the word out, I think. Churches aren't used to dealing in an interdenominational, interfaith way, so that's a slight barrier we have to overcome. But ultimately, they see there is common ground in how we live on this planet and interact with each other.
You're expanding out into other states. This model, and it's more than a model, it's actually a process, is expanding. You personally are looking into expanding this. What states are you going to be looking at, Mark?
Well, we've gotten a grant from the Environmental Protection Agency to look at setting up this aggregation model and replicating it in other states. And we're currently looking at a number of states, and we're trying to find a sort of a confluence of several things. We haven't not picked the five states yet, but we'll be getting a three-year contract to do that. We've reviewed the states, and the criteria we're looking at to select a state is one that it has a small business presence that is promoting energy efficient and green businesses as part of their mission. One is we have to find a business organization that says green businesses are a growth industry for us, and it is a smart business for us to start working with green businesses. That's, you know, wind farm developers and manufacturers of energy efficient products and organic lawn care, etc. So, one, I got to find a state where there's a progressive business organization. Two, we have to look for a state where there is the ability to form an interfaith power and light, that there is either the beginning of an organization there or an interest among the religious community and a recognition that the environment has a relationship to religion. Third thing we have to find is that the state, each of these states, they get money to promote Energy Star in their states. We need to you know, work with a state that is willing to take their Energy Star promotion dollars and invest it in this kind of a facilitated aggregation process.
Well, Mark, if people are interested in contacting you and learning more, how can they do that?
They can simply send me an email. It's probably the easiest way. My email is mhc@sbam.org.
Mark Clevey, Vice President of SBAM, the Small Business Association of Michigan, and the Director of the Energy Star Program, thanks for joining us here on the Wild Side News.
I truly enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And I invite all people of faith to reunite with the earthly mission. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News, bringing you the weekly update on the Voice of the Earth.